Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 073032, United States of America versus Edward Kenneth Kelly, Jr., appellant. Mr. Regatt for the appellant, Ms. Nyland for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Attorney Raymond Regatt, on behalf of the defendant appellant, Mr. Edward Kelly. In a nutshell, this case really comes down to the following proposition. If the government had charged Mr. Kelly in a single indictment with both conspiracy and a separate count of possession with intent to distribute, it would not have been able to get two separate convictions on two separate 924C charges. That's in conformity with this court's holding in Wilson, which the reasoning of which has been adopted by the Second Circuit in Finley. And that really is the basis for the double jeopardy claim.
In other words, you want to breathe life into Grady after Felix.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's a fair.
The prosecutor whether there was any life left in Grady after Felix. I mean, Felix says it's going to limit Grady to simple situations, or a simple single course of conduct, I think is the phrase, as opposed to complicated. But it isn't that clear precisely what the court is saying in Felix.
I think that this is a rather simple fact pattern, despite there's a superficial complexity. But the truth is that the only gun that was found with respect to either the Maryland conspiracy or the possession with intent to distribute in the District of Columbia is the gun that's retrieved during the search on September 2nd.
Does the record tell us whether the drugs are the same?
I don't think the record really tells us specifically that the drugs are the same, but I do think that there are two clear references in the record that the gun that's the subject of the 924C in the District of Columbia is the same gun.
Yeah, the prosecutor didn't dispute that at the plea transcript. But what's your best case for saying that the court can look beyond the face of the indictment to determine
I think that's the
government's argument, isn't it, that you can only look at the face of the indictment?
I understood the government's argument to be basically that, look, these are really two separate offenses, that what's going on in the District of Columbia is not necessarily what's involved in the Maryland prosecution. But I think to say that that's a disingenuous argument is perhaps a little too strong, but pretty clearly, the judge at the change of plea colloquy is operating that, look, you know, it really is the same factual predicate, that the possession with intent to distribute prosecution.
We've got different predicate crimes.
They are different predicate crimes, right? And I think that's perhaps what gives us this layer of complexity that perhaps really isn't there after all.
Different predicate crimes have been the key to these cases right along.
Well, I don't think that's true with Wilson. I mean, I think in Wilson, there you had the murder conviction plus the conviction for, you know, witness tampering, because the murderer is a witness who's going to be testifying, and they try to nail the defendant with two counts of 924C, and I really think that's what this case comes down to. If the government could not have brought one single indictment. Let's just assume for the sake of argument that the conspiracy that is touching apparently Washington, D.C. and Maryland had been brought all in one indictment here. It does not appear that the government would have been able to say, okay, these are two separate crimes or two separate predicate crimes, and therefore we can charge the same gun that's only been found once, the only evidence of which apparently is.
But the nature of this offense is that it doesn't stand alone, right? So that was why I was questioning questioning whether it was different drugs, because in a single indictment, if the government had charged it on September 2nd, 2005, your client had this gun and, I don't know, a bag of heroin, say.
Right.
But then the District of Columbia came along and charged him with cocaine on that same date, but with the same gun. I mean, that would be a different case, wouldn't it?
I don't know. Well, I think the case...
Depending on how the indictment as to conspiracy read, I...
Perhaps, but I don't think there's confusion that the gun in this case is just this one gun that's found in this.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just suggesting the identity of the drugs. Is that critical?
Well, let's say that it is. Let's, for the sake of argument, the drugs that are involved that are seized in the D.C. prosecution are all part and parcel of the conspiracy in Maryland. That seems pretty clear. Those were alleged as overt acts. In the Maryland indictment.
What I thought the government's argument was that Felix says different predicate crimes, end of discussion, because you only look at the face of the indictment.
Right.
And yet it has that language in there about Grady.
Yeah.
All right? And then you read Grady. All right? And sort of the question is, this could be Grady, but we don't know from this record. I thought that's what the district court was trying to determine, and the prosecutor said he was totally unaware of the Maryland conviction and really could provide no information.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. Although I think by the time sentencing came around again, the judge references the fact that, here the charges are, you pled to offenses, the charges based in part on the identical conduct for which you stood convicted in this case is what you had been prosecuted for in Maryland. I mean, I think what the judge is doing in this case is saying that, look, you can be charged for conspiracy, get acquitted for conspiracy, and you can be charged for possession with intent to distribute as, whether that's an overt act or not, there's no prohibition against the government prosecuting you for those two offenses. And I think that perhaps is the confusion, because while I would concede that, certainly, the language in Wilson and the facts in Wilson are more akin to the facts in this case than any other case. And I thought the reference to Washington, the dicta in Washington, was an apposite, because there the gun was used on two separate occasions, right? It was October 5th of 1993 and again December 17th. So I don't think we're here to dispute that. Look, you could potentially get separate 924C convictions, but I think you have to have separate instances of the gun being used.
In Wilson, neither of the two offenses, one was not a lesser included of the other, was it?
Yeah.
You know the case of Sturmowski in the Tenth Circuit?
No, Your Honor, I can't say that I do.
Well, the charges are maintaining a place for manufacturing meth and attempting to manufacture meth. And there's one gun and two 924C charges, and that's upheld.
Are there two separate instances that are removed in time and place, I think would be
the... Well, he maintains the place over a period of time, and he goes there and attempts to make meth.
Okay.
During that period of time.
Well, if there are two separate instances of making the meth, I think that's fine, and perhaps that's the argument. That's what makes this maybe a little easier to understand the appellant's argument. Again, that perhaps
there were, although I don't think that's part of the rationale of the case. But I think in fact there were.
Okay.
Multiple.
Yeah.
But I
think that's a critical factual distinction. Otherwise, that we could theoretically have cases where there are 100 counts of 924C, and I don't think that's what Congress intended with.
Well,
this.
Wait a minute, 100 counts of 924C, you'd need 100 predicate offenses.
Separate offenses, right.
Yeah. So I'm not too worried about that. That doesn't come along.
But I think the offenses have to be, meaning I think it more focuses on when the gun is found, more so than it does on the fact that, you can charge this three different ways the same conduct. I think that's the difference. I do think that's the difference.
Say that again, would you?
Okay.
Because that's... I'm
little confusing.
That's the difference. I want to make sure I understand it.
I think what I'm getting at is you could theoretically have a common nucleus of operative fact. There's a fact pattern where at a specific place, time, and date, a defendant has committed theoretically four different crimes, but there's only one gun involved.
Mm-hmm.
Our argument would be you could charge those separate crimes, but you could only charge the 924C once.
Or sales?
If they're close in time.
Well, this yes. That's a mare's nest. Judge Winter makes that point in dissent in the Second Circuit case.
Yes.
That if we're getting into this question of how close in time, then every case is going to be susceptible to this kind of an argument, and it's not really in anyone's interest to be as vague as that.
Well, I don't know if you could have a hard and fast rule with it, but I think.
Well, if the question is can you charge separate predicate crimes, that's a hard and fast rule. Right?
Well, yes, true, but that's not what the Finley Court did, unfortunately. And I understand it's not binding precedent on this circuit, but the rationale in Finley was based on Wilson. And I see that my time is expired.
I will give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Ginsburg.
Good morning. May it please the court, Suzanne Nyland for the United States. I think it's important to point out, as the court is well aware here, that these arguments we're speaking of here in the double jeopardy context are raised in a plea situation. And where appellant entered a plea, particularly in plea hearings here, which went on over a period of 2 days, and these questions were fully vetted and argued, and the defendant repeatedly assured the court that he understood and his counsel repeatedly consulted with him. He, at this point, can only prevail if he shows, based on the face of the indictments, that there was a double jeopardy problem. And he can't show that from the face of the indictments here, even though the record tells us a little more about the charges. He is restricted to the face of the indictments, and they're clearly different crimes.
What do you do with the discussion in Felix of
as I understand, Felix is the case that says that the substantive crime and the conspiracy are not the same offense for double jeopardy purposes. At least that's what I recall of the case.
You cited in your brief.
Right.
And I thought that's what you were relying on here in your argument.
We
but
are.
In Felix, Chief Justice Rehnquist discusses Grady. And my question is, how does the government read that?
I apologize in saying that I don't recall the discussion of Grady from Felix.
Well, in Felix, do you recall what? Well, if you don't recall, you don't recall. Okay.
In any event, as has been pointed out, these are two separate predicate crimes, and I think factually it's important for me to note that in the Maryland indictment, there is no mention of the cocaine that was seized here with the gun in Mr. Kelly's case.
As I understand it, is that the way the Maryland indictment reads, it doesn't have an overt acts part. So when you look at the face of the indictment, you don't know whether these are the same drugs that were involved in the D.C. indictment, do you?
That's correct. There's no mention of them at all, or whether that's exactly right. And I think that's one bar to his claim.
So the question is whether or not if it was the exact same drugs on the exact same day, in the exact same place, with the exact same person, with the exact same gun, and he was acquitted in Maryland of all charges against him, can the United States go to another jurisdiction and charge him with that discrete, what I'll call overt act?
Yes, it can.
And what's your best case for that?
I don't recall the names, I apologize, but I know that in our brief we discussed.
I think the problem is, what I've suggested to you is Grady. The man was arrested on traffic offenses and then subsequently indicted for murder. And here, it's sort of the reverse. He's indicted initially for the broader offense, and then later, after his acquittal, indicted for the lesser offense.
That would therefore support the bringing of the charges in the order that they were brought here, assuming that we would drill down past the face of the indictment, which we know we can't do in a plea situation.
Well, I guess what I'm saying, though, is that Felix says difficult predicate offenses, but it doesn't say, and we're overruling Grady. Quite the contrary. It says we're confining Grady to a single course of conduct. And the hypothetical I gave you is a single course of conduct.
The problem, I think, here is the assumption that what he was acquitted of in Maryland encompassed what he was charged with in the District of Columbia.
Well, that's why I want to know how far you read the language about you can only look at the face of the indictment. Those cases, as I read them, are cases where you look at the indictment and he's charged with armed robbery in one case, and in another case he's charged with,
Carjacking.
So you look at the face of the indictment and it's perfectly clear. Conspiracy is fuzzier. And the way this indictment reads, you can't tell whether these are just this single course of conduct. And so my point is, don't you have to look beyond the indictment? And that's what the district court was trying to get some information about.
And your point is that the defendant here has the burden on this.
That's exactly right. And he has yet to actually demonstrate to the court, assuming we should drill down into the substance of the case and not stop at the face of the indictment, which we believe we should. It would be the appellant's burden to come in and say, you know, this is exactly the kind of evidence that went in, exactly what the charges were. And there's been no suggestion here that the jury ever even heard about the cocaine that was taken from appellant's apartment along with the gun on September 2nd, 2004. No. We just have no basis to believe the two are related at all.
You're talking about the jury in the Maryland case?
Correct. We just simply don't know that from the face of this indictment, which encompassed a four-year conspiracy and many other defendants.
Defendant under oath said it was the same gun. You don't deny that, do you?
No, I don't deny that. I don't know that it's relevant to the analysis for the double jeopardy claim that arises from following a plea. But yes, he did say that.
Well, but to be clear, is the government's position then, under my hypothetical, that there is no double jeopardy problem?
That's right. I don't think there is a double jeopardy problem. Because I understand the appellant's claim to primarily be one based on simultaneity, which is more of a complaint about double punishment for the same act of holding the gun than it is being hauled into court for two separate charges repeatedly. I don't quite follow what his claim is in that sense in this context.
His argument either here or in the district court.
Well, he has made a simultaneity argument in his brief, and perhaps it's not responsive to the court's question, but I would note simply that I think it's very important that in one particular case in the conspiracy, when he's acquitted, it doesn't necessarily at all impact the PUID charge because, A, it wasn't necessarily part of the Maryland. It doesn't have a double jeopardy bearing on the PUID charge. In other words, it wouldn't be wrong to charge him, as appellant's counsel suggested, in that first indictment in Maryland, putting aside the venue problems for now, which is another quirk in the case. If the government had charged conspiracy and the government had a separate count that charged the PUID cocaine and then a couple of counts related to those based on 924C, it wouldn't have been anything wrong with charging those things. There might or might not have been a problem with imposing multiple punishments for the possession of the gun in a single course of conduct under his simultaneity theory.
Well, what I'm stumbling over here, and you may be right, but I just don't know how you get around Grady. And the Supreme Court, you know, has continued to cite it, so it's there.
I guess I just do respect, I have to say, I don't know how appellant gets around Bros, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, because he's absolutely got to show the court from the face of the indictment and not from our guesses about the record, which I think also support the possibility that this cocaine had nothing to do with this case. There were multiple other defendants, and the case was venued in Maryland and encompassed a four-year conspiracy versus one day of a possession of a gun where he also happened to have cocaine that isn't in that indictment. We really don't have a reason to believe, and it hasn't been demonstrated by appellant, that the two cases are the same. I think his burden is quite heavy there even before the court reaches the question of Grady and Felix. And I think he has not satisfied that burden. He has actually said, at a minimum, his burden is plain error. And we have said his burden would be invited error because all of this was discussed fully below. And I don't think the court is presented with that question of if there is a strain between Grady and Felix because of the procedural bars to this claim.
I have to acknowledge that I have not delved into this because I'm under the impression that Dixon overruled Grady.
And I apologize for not being able to speak to that issue, Your Honor. I just don't know. Anyway, like I said, it's an issue I don't think the court needs to address.
Felix cites Grady, that's in 1992, and then in 93, Dixon comes out and seems to overrule Grady. I'm going to read you what it says. Pardon? We have concluded that Grady must be overruled. Unlike Blockberger analysis, whose definition of what prevents two crimes from being the, quote, same offense, close quote, Fifth Amendment, has deep historical roots and has been accepted in numerous precedents of this court. Grady lacks constitutional roots. The, quote, same conduct, close quote, rule that announced is wholly inconsistent with earlier Supreme Court precedent and with the clear common law understanding of double jeopardy. Quoting a case in subsequent prosecution, while it is true the conduct of the accused was one and the same, two offenses resulted, each of which has an element not embraced in the other. We need not discuss the many proofs of these statements which were set forth at length in the Grady dissent. See opinion of Scalia. So I'm
it's that
loss.
Key language element that you just read. In any event, we can discuss that a little.
I think we'll have to. Well, we may ask parties to submit further on this. Then we'll see what happens.
Very well. Thank you, Your Honor.
Got you familiar with these cases?
Yes. Well, Your Honor, not Grady. I am familiar with Felix, and then the cite from the Supreme Court when I did the preliminary research. But I frankly,
how about
zero,
Dixon?
I'm sorry.
How about Dixon?
No.
That seems to be the last word.
No, I have not studied okay. Dixon, and so I have no. I mean, I'd welcome the opportunity to submit an additional brief.
What were you going to say?
Oh, just that I thought the record, the attorney representing Mr. Kelly did make clear that the drugs found actually, that this is all part of the more global conspiracy.
Well, that I think I don't think that was an issue. The question was it the same drugs?
Well,
that it might be the same conspiracy, I don't think is.
I understand. And it may be that it does, therefore, need a remand to develop that factually, and that would perhaps come under the ineffective assistance claim. That Mr. Kelly raises.
Any response on invited error?
I don't think it's invited error. I mean, I mean, with respect to a guilty plea, the invited error doctrine that counsel cited seemed more to do with things such as improper jury instructions. I mean, theoretically, any time you try to argue on appeal that your plea is involuntary or unintelligent, that you know you could come back and say, well. You know, the error was invited because you keep saying in the plea colloquy that you understand and you're pleading guilty freely and voluntarily. So I don't think it's applicable under these facts.
Well, in the sense that in other contexts, it would make the error beyond reach. But the argument here is, or at least there is a less aggressive argument, right, that it simply narrows the scope of review.
It may narrow the scope of review, but it's not a.
I mean, in that sense, it's duplicative of Brochi.
Perhaps.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Regan. You were appointed to represent the appellant in this case.
Oh yes, it's been my pleasure.
And we very much appreciate your help. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Case is submitted.